I know what you're thinking. Is my coffee fresh, or was it roasted months ago? Well, to tell you the truth, in all this excitement, I kinda lost track myself. Especially since there's no way to tell when most coffee was roasted. But since freshness is the most reliable way to ensure the quality and taste of your coffee, you gotta ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Yes, I do.
That's because you have already made your own luck by switching to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that are always fair trade and directly sourced. They offer a variety of blends to choose from and even decaf and half calf. But what makes Sparkplug special is that they deliver this outstanding coffee to you in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it so that it always reaches you guaranteed fresh and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug a la carte, or you can join the Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries. It's completely flexible and customizable, and there's no commitment. And if you tell them how you heard about them by using the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, Sparkplug will give you 20% off your next coffee order. So what are you waiting for? It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100
Project. And action.
Greetings, movie likers, and thanks for diving headfirst into the 407th Ellis's Analysis here on the Top 100 Project. We discuss and we spoil old-ass films, and we always knock your socks clean off. Or we try to. Clint Eastwood is the star of this movie, and we talked about his modern classic Unforgiven, plus 122 other flicks that made the AFI's 1998 and 2007 100 Years, 100 Movies lists. All those are so far back in the archives, you'll have to keep on scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. I'm the simmering with rage punk hunter who doesn't want to buy new pants. Ryan Ellis.
That moment.
They cost $29.50.
They have a bullet hole in them.
$29.50 is expensive for the early 70s, too, isn't it, for pants?
They're blood-soaked.
Also true. Nothing gets chocolate out, see?
I don't think he's just an exhibitionist and he wants the doctor to see him in his gitch. Anyway, sorry, carry on.
Yeah. Well, here is the hard-boiled hot dog lover who gets to know my wife, Bev.
That's me.
The line that no one ever quotes in the famous speech we're about to talk about, and one of the ones I like the most in it as the response, hey, I gets to know. Harry knows he fired all six shots because he wouldn't risk killing somebody with witnesses right there. He knew he fired six shots. And then the question becomes, what if the punk tried to grab that shotgun? Maybe Harry thinks he can get in there and literally grab the shotgun, but he doesn't have any more bullets.
Yeah, he's bluffing.
Great bluff. And he's so cool and tough. And one of the more famous moments in any movie is in Dirty Harry. But the coming attractions trivia leads into all this. The uber-famous quote in Dirty Harry is the, do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk? Speech. The whole thing is referenced on the AFI's Top 100 Quotes list. And when people think about it, they think about the entire quote. But there's another Harry Callahan witticism that ranks even higher on the AFI's Top 100 Quotes list. What is it?
In the fourth Dirty Harry movie, Sudden Impact, Harry Callahan utters, go ahead, make my day.
Make my day. And of course, a lot of people have conflated the two with, go ahead, punk, make my day, but never said those two together. That was sixth on the list, and this speech in Dirty Harry, the Do I Feel Lucky speech, was 51st. Okay, Dead Right, the working title of this film, was released 50 years ago by Warner Brothers on December 23rd, 1971. That's how old Eastwood is. Not that he looks old in this movie, but this is 50 years ago, and he's already middle-aged when he made this movie.
41 when he made the movie, yeah.
He's still directing movies now, because Cry Macho comes out sometime soon, maybe not this year, the way things are going again with the pandemic, but at some point, he will direct another movie that will get released, I assume, in theaters, although maybe it'll be just HBO Max. Anyway, he's still working in his early 90s now. And it made about 9 times its budget, so obviously Dirty Harry was a monster success, and it did spawn 4 sequels, including, of course, Sudden Impact, which you just referenced a minute ago. But the movie is so old, Bev. Please remind us what it's about. And give us a skinny on Dirty Harry.
Clint Eastwood is Harry Callahan, a grizzled, middle-aged cop who pursues bad guys his own way. Callahan's investigation into an active serial killer called Scorpio leads him to bend one too many rules, allowing the killer to go free on a technicality. So Callahan takes the law into his own hands and deals with Scorpio vigilante style. Consequences be damned.
You're off your rocker, Chief.
You're off your case.
What does that even mean?
It means it gets results.
Dad, sit down.
I couldn't help quoting. Is it
McGarnacle?
McGarnacle! I couldn't stop watching this movie quoting McGarnacle. Obviously, McGarnacle's making fun of all the movies that stole from Dirty Harry.
But also Dirty Harry himself.
Also Dirty Harry, but this movie, as I realized, spawned almost a whole genre of vigilante lone wolf cops.
Police thrillers, yeah. One of the great things about that moment in The Simpsons is that I don't think any of it is animated. As in, we don't see the actual show or movie they're watching. I guess it's supposed to be a movie. And even when that part at the end is, it means it gets results, you stupid chief, dad, sit down, whole bit, is a wide shot of their house. Yeah. There are 150 great quotes in that show. That's one of the more underrated exchanges. It's all about the timing that she says that right on top of him saying, he gets results, you stupid chief. Or, in a nutshell, some lucky fish was just made an inspector in the San Francisco Police Department.
Because he quits his job at the end?
He threw his badge in the water, and that kid, who's probably traumatized for life, when Scorpio grabbed him and Harry shot with the kid in Scorpio's arms, was fishing. So I'm guessing there's fish in that quarry, and some fish is now able to say, I guess I am deputized.
He got the badge. He wears it proudly. He shoots before asking questions.
But it is a good payoff to the Do I Feel Lucky, because he's so cool, calm, and collected, and almost enjoys, well, he definitely enjoys himself through a lot of what he does in this movie. With the black guy earlier on, after he foils that bank robbery, but at the end, it's all this seething. You have to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? What do you punk? He wants to shoot Scorpio so badly. He is so glad Scorpio reaches for that gun, because
he made his day.
Yep. And also, Harry has probably lost his job after what's happened there, regardless of whether Scorpio pulled the gun or whatever happens with him, if he just arrests him, because maybe that's why he throws his badge away. But then, apparently, I haven't seen the sequels in, I don't know, 15 or probably 20 years. They don't even address the fact that he effectively quit at the end of this movie, which probably is homaging a movie from almost 20 years earlier, High Noon. Gary Cooper throws his badge in the dirt when he saves the day in that movie. And then Point Break, 20 years after this, did the same thing. He's not coming back. When Keanu has finally foiled Patrick Swayze, who's going to die in those giant waves in Australia. But it seems like Johnny Utah has quit the FBI after being in the FBI for a very brief period of time. The three movies at least have done that badge-throwing scene, and a fish can now claim to be a cop.
I read that it was a direct homage to High Noon.
Oh, there you go. Okay, one of the reasons to cover this movie is this part, the numbers. There are so many of them on Dirty Harry. The Rotten Tomatoes critics like this movie a lot. 89% of them say, good, good. It has a ranking of 7.8 out of 10 on the strength of 46 reviews. That's pretty damn good. And 90% of audiences, 9-0. But it was a very divisive film. And there were protests at the Oscars in 1972, so for the 71 films. But this wasn't even nominated for anything. What are you protesting? It was sixth at the 1971 U.S. box office. We've covered these three, and they're all AFI films. The French Connection was number three. A Clockwork Orange was number seven, and The Last Picture Show was number nine. And of course, French Connection, which has a lot of ties to this movie, was the Best Picture winner that year. And this was the era of vigilante cop movies, the Batman of their day, if you will, because also Death Wish was only a few years later. He wasn't a cop, but it's awfully similar to what happens in this movie, which is you've done something bad and you got away with it and the system is not going to get you. I'll get you. The National Film Registry put this movie in their archives in 2012, same year as Breakfast at Tiffany's, A League of Their Own, and The Matrix. What a foursome that is. We've covered all these movies now, though. And for the AFI, it was 51st, top 100 quotes, like I said, with the famous quote, we know it now. 41st on the top 100 thrills, Psycho was number one, and Harry Callahan was 17th on the top 50 heroes. Atticus Finch, his polar opposite, was number one. It was nominated for the top 25 music scores, and also for the 1998 and 2007 top 100 list. So the main list could have been one of the greatest movies of all time, but didn't make either one of those. But let's get back to that whole thing, because that's what this movie's so controversial about. Is this guy a hero, especially in the way we want him to be a hero? Maybe that's really the better question here, is he does the right thing by killing a very bad man, but is it okay? Was it then? Is it now?
Okay, I have a lot to say about the controversy, but I feel like the thing that the film does that makes it get away with it, and maybe the worst thing it does because it turns it into a more effective piece of propaganda, is it portrays Harry as always being right. Every time he bends a rule, he's right to do it. It helps him catch the bad guy. His actions never incriminate innocent people or do anything but maybe mildly inconvenience the public. They never...
Not fully true. In the robbery that leads to the "Do I Feel Lucky" punk speech, he's shooting at them, as he should be, because he does say, "Halt!" And one of the guys shoots at him. And it's one thing for them to do it because they're criminals and they're probably killers. But he's still a cop. And there are innocent people around.
But they don't get shot. My point is...
No, I know, but he's shooting anywhere near their vicinity. And he shoots when the kid is in Scorpio's arms at the end.
I mean, he's perfect, right? He never makes mistakes. He is a sharp shooter. He can win every fight. So an audience is going to interpret this as, well, he can shoot. Because he is the good guy and he knows what he's doing. Of course, there's very good reasons why cops should never shoot into a crowd. But in this movie's logic, Harry should. Because... he's just that good. And that's why I say it's a dangerous movie as a piece of propaganda, because it's definitely making that argument. In the world of this film, the rules are nothing but roadblocks stopping a hero from doing his job, when in reality, the rules are there to protect us and our rights and to stop cops from overreaching and, of course, shooting into crowds. The movie's not implying he got lucky, because he never makes a mistake.
He didn't get lucky, punk.
No. And also, all the foils in this film are Harry's superiors, who sit at desks in their offices and they just bark orders at him and other cops, and they simultaneously are hog-tying them with regulations. They're out of touch. They're insecure. They don't get the job done like Harry does. So I think that's why Harry gets away with it. The audience is always going to forgive him because he never does shoot a pedestrian or an innocent bystander. He doesn't hit that little boy when he's taking such a risk, shooting straight at somebody with a child hostage. He maybe gets caught peeping in somebody's window, but
he does get caught doing that.
We know he's actually looking for the criminal. He doesn't seem interested.
One nice touch in that scene too is that when Chico comes in to help him out, he wants to arrest those guys for beating on a cop. They didn't know he was a cop. They thought he was actually literally just peeping, and they're trying to help out their friend. What's her name? Mary or something like that?
Hot Mary, they call
her. Hot Mary, right. A lot of nudity in this film, including Hot Mary.
Yeah, they really took advantage of that R rating, and they showed as much tits and ass as they... Actually, full frontal for the 70s. This must have been pretty scandalous. That's probably what helped get butts in seats.
Well, you're talking about the dead girl coming out of the...
No, it's not just her. They go to the strip club, and you see full frontal nudity.
Oh, right, of course, yes. Yeah, right. But anyway, after they pull him off the trash can... and then beat on him, but Chico stops them. He wants to arrest those guys. He says, "Let him go." Because he realizes that they're not really wrong. What they were doing was trying to defend their community, and he's not mad at them, even though they just wailed on him a little bit. And Harry does get wailed on a lot in this film. Mel Gibson probably should have done a Dirty Harry movie, because before we knew he was such a prick and such a racist and all the rest, sexist and God, I don't know, we'll go on the whole list. But he really probably should have played this character, though, because he's about getting beat on in his movies, and his characters are. Somebody pointed that out a while ago, including Passion of the Christ,
South
which isn't
Park
him.
Did a whole episode about how he actually is just a masochist.
And as
his
a
movies
film
are basically
star,
torture porn.
Over and over and over. I wouldn't say Clint Eastwood is, but in this film, he gets attacked multiple times. Obviously, we just talked about that one with those people who are trying to help out their friend Hot Mary. But one key element to this, too, and this is the complexity of being a cop. We already know he's a crazy killer. We have evidence of it. We know for sure as the movie watchers, but even this guy without 100% proof knows that Scorpio is a deranged killer who has to be stopped. He had said while he's kicking Harry, "I'm going to let her die." So for so many reasons, he needs to go down. And for so many reasons, he probably should just be flat out shot. But that's not Harry's job. Harry's job is to arrest him and let the process work and have him go to jail for decades and decades, maybe the rest of his life. But also in that scene, though, Scorpio is kicking him. He's torturing him, which is a payback in the football stadium when, and understandably so, in a 24 kind of way, Harry's under the gun. There's a clock ticking. The girl's already dead, I think, at this point. But he steps on an already injured man, meaning Scorpio, in the football stadium. "I got my rights." Scorpio isn't wrong. He should be able to call his lawyer. He's captured. He's down. It's over. But Harry steps in his leg because he wants the information about where the girl is. And that's the complexity of this film, where if you watch this movie, then you can understand his motivations. And he got beat on, whatever that was, days before by the same guy. But he should probably have, and I understand this is hard to do as a human being, detachment from the fact, "You kicked me, you piece of fucking shit, not that long ago. I'm going to now step on your leg, which is probably a lot less than what you did to me. And I want to save a girl." Go ahead.
Well, I think that the scene in the park where he's getting his ass beat by Scorpio is also a mirror of the scene at the beginning of the film where he has the bank robber dead to rights and he's toying with him. Callahan has the leg injury, much like Scorpio gets injured in the same spot in his leg with a knife, instead of a bullet. But of course, when Harry Callahan gets shot in the leg, even immediately after getting
shot, he no-sells it.
He doesn't even break his swagger. He doesn't have a limp at all. He appears to be completely unaffected by a bullet to the leg.
He's not doing it. And I saw one of the movies like this last night. We've talked about it before lots of times, the old gangster films, the constipation death. I saw a constipation death last night. No, it was a constipation shot in the shoulder. And he wasn't even really that constipated. And Harry isn't constipated at all. I'm too tough to sell it.
It is as if he doesn't feel it at all. And then, of course, when Scorpio gets hurt in the leg, he has the opposite reaction. His limp is outrageous and ridiculous and exaggerated. And through the rest of the film, he never seems to recover at all. He has this ridiculous hopping limp that makes him look like he's skipping like a little girl even. They make him into such an outrageous villain. I think the villains, whether it be the bureaucracy or Scorpio, it's very much the Ayn Rand school of villains, where they are strawman villains that are fine in the sense that they're over the top and you hate them and that makes you love Harry.
As it's
makes
written,
him that much more of a hero.
As it's written, it's well played by Andrew Robinson.
No, I'm not criticizing his performance at all. I'm criticizing the writing in the sense that they clearly had a point to make. This is a serial killer who's also a hippie. Feels made up. Are there really a lot of serial killers that have peace sign belt buckles? I doubt it. Maybe there was one, and maybe it was ironic, but it was 1971. We're only talking 2 years after the Summer of Love. There was a divide in America, and this movie knew exactly which half of Americans were its audience and who they were playing to. It actually reminds me of American Sniper, which is a okay movie, but was the first unabashedly right-wing movie to be made and put on the big screen in a long time, unless you want to count the fact that not so secretly, Marvel films are pretty right-wing.
Yeah, true. But also about the wars, meaning Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, specifically about something that is political.
The modern wars.
And very partisan. So liberals watch it and we all roll our eyes. Meanwhile, the right wing in America, it's so refreshing for them to see something that appealed to them that they made that movie the biggest hit of the year. It beat every superhero movie, everything else that should have blown the box office away. Who would have ever expected that to happen?
It's an Eastwood movie. He doesn't have huge budgets in his films.
No, and it's just not the kind of movie that would usually be number one. And it's because there's this untapped audience. Now, I don't know if that was true necessarily in 1971, but I know that in 1971, probably people who were disgusted by hippies probably felt pretty marginalized
this movie's success is
a counter reaction to the hippies
is Nixon's silent majority thing.
These are the people that went and saw it and identified with him. I mean, it's also because it's a very good movie.
It's very entertaining.
It's really well made. It's a really taut thriller.
Perfect casting in the lead role.
Yeah, it's not a stupid movie at all. It's very intelligent and it's plotting and there's just plain cool stuff that happens in it. Cool action sequences, creative, original shots and set pieces. Great performances, of course, from Eastwood and Andrew Robinson, who plays Scorpio. And then it was tapping into a market that was probably underserved at the time. It's kind of like the death of disco. It was a backlash.
That market's probably always underserved. I understand why they get a little frustrated when they seem left out by Hollywood. This is what good movie watching, movie viewing, movie making, movie anything is all about. Because I don't know how many people listen to this podcast will now fold their arms. Or maybe they didn't bother with this one, actually. They might have deleted this one if it came into their device and said, I'm not listening to that. I don't care about Dirty Harry. Or maybe they didn't see it at all. It is 50 years old.
I don't know if people really vilify Dirty Harry now the way they did 50 years ago.
But the movie's so timely because of what we saw last year with Black Lives Matter. Plus the AFI list. I always like to acknowledge that the movie's got a lot of AFI recognition, as this did, and was successful and was zeitgeisty then, and has remained so now, partly because of the complexity of police work. Harry goes way beyond the law in this film, but Scorpio has to be stopped. I mentioned 24, a series I never saw, but I know the basic premise. Those terrorists have to be stopped, and that's how people like Dick Cheney justified torture. The ticking time bomb, which probably rarely ever happens in reality, but it's always, that's what it's going to be. If we don't stop this terrorist, then they're going to blow up New York, or they're going to blow up Middle America, which they'd never blow up. It'd be New York or D.C. or L.A.
No, they're going straight to Milwaukee.
All right. Well, you say a fairly big city, actually. It'd be, anyway. But I get why in filmmaking you go for these extremes, and this movie does play into that. But this movie was called Fascist, I think even by Pauline Kael, back in 1971. Never mind in our woke times. I could see why people would have issues with the way he is now, because he does break so many rules. His superiors literally tell him, don't do this, don't do that. You shot at a guy, what was it, last year, last month or something. Yeah, but his dick was out and he was chasing a woman with a butcher's knife.
And then the mayor says, good point.
So Harry's
really,
not wrong.
Put a pin on it.
He was stopping a guy from undoubtedly doing something to this woman who probably wanted to both rape her, and I guess if he has a butcher's knife, kill her. But at the same point, this guy hasn't yet done anything wrong. This is the complexity of our world, and that's why it does frustrate me when I hear about defund the police. When you and other people have explained that to me, because when I first heard it, I thought the same thing my mother did, which is, that seems stupid. You can't defund the police. When people actually explain it, it makes more sense. Doesn't make complete sense, makes a lot more sense. But that is an absolutely terrible marketing slogan. It always was. It still is. Because generally, people don't know anything. And you say something like that, and they think, oh my God, they're going to have people like the Scorpio Killer out there in the streets, and there won't be a Harry Callahan to stop them. Nothing is as extreme as what's in this movie, but that's what people will think. And if you don't realize that, if you want to do that, yeah, but the world should be the way I want it to be. Okay, it doesn't matter what you think the world should be. This is the problem I have with the defund the police thing, is that there is so much gray area. Harry was told over and over again not to do what he does in this movie, but then they do justify it with the fact that, okay, he saved a woman from being hurt, but the guy hasn't committed a crime yet. And our society is all about, you can't stop people like a Minority Report from committing crimes when they haven't yet committed them. This is the complexity of this issue, and that's why I hate when people last year especially, maybe into this year, are so extreme, and maybe they've done the work that I haven't done. So fair point to them. The politicians, like some of the people in the squad, with the defund the police, and that's all they really seem to say that I've ever heard. But it's so much more complex than that.
But this movie isn't nuanced.
This movie isn't, that's true.
Okay, you're arguing that defund the police is not a nuanced enough statement, slogan.
Am I wrong?
No, I actually agree with you that I think the marketing, the messaging could definitely be better. Clearly, there's a huge problem with the way that police operate in America, to some extent in Canada too.
Oh, definitely.
We are far from free.
Probably every country.
This problem. Yeah, probably every country. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. And then you have a movie like this made in the 70s when I think they were having the same arguments. You know, police were hardly popular between civil rights and hippies. It's not that long after. I'm going to get the details wrong, but what's the university where police opened fire on all those students who were protesting?
Kent State.
Kent State. You know, cops weren't popular then, so this movie comes out as a response, and all the villains are straw men. They're not realistic villains. They're not nuanced villains. And Harry is a fantasy.
Including his giant gun, which, as John Milius points out on the making of this movie, I think it is, because he actually had a hand in writing the screenplay. He and Terrence Malick are two uncredited writers of this movie.
I know, isn't that crazy?
But Milius apparently wrote, if not all, then a lot of the Do I Feel Lucky Punk speech. Milius points out that giant 44 Magnum is not a gun you'd use
as a cop. I know.
It's a hunter's gun. This guy is hunting people.
The movie is dangerous as a piece of propaganda because it's such a good and effective film. And even if you hate the message, I hate the message. But I still really liked this movie. And I like Harry as a hero. He's a fantasy for people who hated the people who hate cops. Just like right now, there's a lot of people who hear defund the police, and even if they understood the nuance of that statement, still would rather have police subjugating the poor and minorities to massive civil rights abuses, literally murdering people for no good reason.
We've seen evidence of this.
There are lots of people who are fully okay with that, because it's protecting their property, their gated neighborhoods, their sense of safety, their sense of white superiority.
And it's one less N-word in the world,
exactly,
according to them.
Like, whether they realize it or not, it is, I got mine, Jack. I'm safe. I don't care what the cops have to do to get me this way. I don't care who suffers. As long as my world is still pristine and safe, then everything they do is okay. As long as somebody gets shot for keying my Mercedes. That's probably an extreme example. Maybe I'm creating a straw man of my own by inventing this evil rich person who doesn't care what happens
the
to
the St. Louis
world.
Couple that brandished guns in their front yard
I mean,
recently got pardoned by the governor of Missouri.
Of course.
Now, I don't know what exactly they should have been charged with.
Lock them away and throw the key? What do you want to happen to them? They've been humiliated. They're never going to change their mind.
It's also
they're never going to be enlightened.
The gun country, and they held guns in their front yard. Very uncool. I'm like everybody else when I see that. I'm thinking, what is wrong with you? They're walking past your house. Calm the fuck down. Couple, not the black people or probably white people
the
too.
Looks on their faces
walking past.
Too.
We're going to take you out. They are
it's
so lame.
So embarrassing.
But I don't know what the law is against them in the gun country because they're on their property holding guns. They didn't shoot anybody. This is why this movie is so complex. This is why this issue is so complex.
So talking about how this movie is a fantasy for people like that who want to say, see, the rapist was naked running down with a butcher knife. Well, that doesn't actually happen. Rapists are much more subtle than that, and cops kill innocent people all the time.
But if you're a judge and you hear that exact thing, and the cop shot the guy, I assume killed him. I forget if the mayor or whoever
was. Yeah, he killed him.
Right. But according to our laws, American laws, probably same with Canadian laws, you aren't supposed to, as a cop, murder people for what they might do.
No, you're a cop. You're supposed to chase them down and apprehend them.
Put a hole in their leg rather than in their face.
Well, actually, they're trained not to do that. They're trained
I know. We've talked about that in other podcasts.
So maybe that happens once in a cop's entire career, that they have a criminal that's that obviously dangerous and obviously needs to be taken down, and you can rationalize violence. Can you rationalize violence against the bank robbers who are trying to run away and he shoots them in the back? That never comes back to haunt him. Maybe they were armed, but we don't know. But
you know,
he just
key
shoots
thing
into
in that
a crowd
scene?
And he shoots two black people.
I was reading online, some guy I've never noticed before, and I've watched that scene. I've seen this movie probably four or five times over the years, but I've watched that scene on YouTube many times too, including prepping for this podcast. I guess they're right when they say this online, that in the big speech at the end he says, "Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Buck?" And you know what that reference is. That's a racist reference, what you call a black guy, rather than the N-word or so many other ones.
He doesn't say punk the first time, he says
if you
buck?
Watch the YouTube clip, it is hard to figure out. I never would have picked up on this if I didn't read it. So maybe these people are wrong.
These were Nixon's people, though.
But also, I wonder how that would necessarily be true, because he says the same thing to a white guy at the end. And he's definitely not going to say buck to the killer. By the way, Andrew Robinson is credited as killer, not as Scorpio, but we all know him as Scorpio. And of course, he's a play on the Zodiac Killer, who really existed
in San Francisco,
and he wrote letters to the Chronicle, like this guy writes letters to the police department, or notes at least. He leaves one for Harry in the very beginning scene. But Harry does call him punk at the end, so if people say that he's saying buck, but they dubbed over punk, but if he's being racist, that isn't the point of that scene, though, either. It maybe gives it more complexity. But his main rival in the whole movie is white. And as you said, is wearing a peace symbol buckle on his belt.
Yeah, everything that Nixon lovers hated. So remind me, because I don't remember the film well enough. We covered The French Connection. Popeye Doyle. He's a good cop, right?
He says racist things, too.
Right, so he has much more gray areas.
He also crosses a lot of lines.
And it's about himself. It's about his own ego. It's about his own obsession. He puts people in danger with that car chase, but he doesn't care. And I think the movie's much more strongly implying that he's wrong. He's out of control.
I think he also, by the way,
support his actions.
I believe he is on the heroes list, too. I'll check that later. But I think he also is one of the top 50 heroes.
And he's a good cop. But Harry is 100% a good cop. You talk about them dubbing over a potentially racist thing. You know that they made a decision to say, no, let's make his morality, his ethics, clean as a whistle. He doesn't like to follow the rules, but he's actually kind of a perfect, maybe not cop, but a perfect protector who always does the right thing.
A dark knight.
He's not trying to get glory. He's not trying to enrich himself. I don't know how his character goes on in the sequels, but when you compare his ethos to our modern cop heroes, who are much more complex, like a lot of anti-heroes, I'm thinking of someone like Vic Mackey or McNulty. Harry is an absolute saint compared to these guys. Mm-hmm. Or hell, compare him to most Marvel heroes who come up against that same pushback from limp politicians and leaders, but always
Captain America of all people.
And do what they have to do to defeat the big bad. America loves a lone wolf who can't be told what to do. Harry is always doing the right thing, where I think he's a fantasy. I'm going to keep coming back to this because I think a big appeal of the film also is that it's a massive piece of fantasy fulfillment. I'm not against fantasy fulfillment. How appealing is he as a hero? He's so tough. He takes a bullet in the leg, doesn't even break his swagger, never walks with a limp for the rest of
his life. He does all that bank robbery job while still chewing in his hot dog.
Right!
That's how cool he is. Schwarzenegger on the making of, because he's in that, goes on and on about, he's eating a hamburger while shooting these guys. A hamburger. It's a hot dog, stupid. Did you watch the movie at all, Arnold, that you supposedly love so much?
So I bet there are lots of people out there, especially dudes, who just get a shot of pure, visceral pleasure from putting themselves in Harry's shoes for 2 hours. Swaggering around San Francisco, always being right, always making the liberal fusspots look foolish.
Or the U.S. Capitol on January 6th.
What are you suggesting?
They think they're Dirty Harry.
And they think they're the good guy.
Treasonous assholes think they're Dirty Harry.
And they think they're tough. These rules are just bogging them down. If they had freedom, then everything would be right, and they would only get the bad guys, and they would always do it right. But who wouldn't want to be Harry Callahan? He is as cool as they come. And again, not criticizing somebody for enjoying. Part of why we love movies is we love identifying with lead characters that we look up to that are better shots, they're cooler, they have the one-liners that nobody could actually come up with under these circumstances. We all want to be them, and there's nothing wrong with that level of enjoyment of films. And one more note about the way that all the bureaucrats are kind of the villains in this film. Part of it, of course, is a comment on, I guess, the nanny state that they're criticizing. Also, though, it's just a really easy conflict for a screenwriter to insert an incompetent milquetoast bureaucrat to get in the hero's way. You could read a lot into it, but you could also just read into it that it's, I don't want to say a bit of lazy screenwriting, but it's a cliche because all scripts are more interesting when there's conflict in every single scene, and sometimes you have to really force that conflict, and a shitty boss is a great way to just inject conflict where there doesn't need to be.
The funny thing is, Harry's superiors are relatively reasonable. Bressler, played by Harry Gardino, who is in The Enforcer, so one of the sequels to this, I don't know what happened, maybe he died because he doesn't seem to have been in the other three sequels, and he's also in Clint's orangutan flicks, along with Ruth Gordon, who is in Harold and Maude. She's Ma in those movies, so we've seen a lot of the... Maybe we should cover Any Which Way But Loose. The universe is telling us to. We're not going to. We are not going to.
Spare me.
But he seems like a pretty good boss, and he seems to get along with Harry on a personal level. They seem to be clicking relatively well. He's not being a complete milquetoast. Even the mayor, John Vernon, who was in The Outlaw Josie Wales, so obviously Clint must have liked him to have worked with him again a few years later. That's a really good Western, by the way. One of Clint's more underrated Westerns. And he's also the dean. You stupid dean! In Animal House, he is way more of a rule follower, an unreasonable idiot, I guess, in Animal House, as I remember that movie, than he is in this. He makes very good points. And like you said, when Harry says about how the guy had his dick out and a knife in his hand was going to kill the woman, rape the woman, good point. So he's not a complete idiot about that. And even when Harry meets with the DA, Joseph Summer, making his debut, as was Andrew Robinson, in this film. So we've covered him in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He's the narrator in Sophie's Choice. He plays the older Stingo. And then Chris and I covered him in The Mighty Ducks, our very first podcast on scoring at the movies. He's the DA in that one scene only. He makes reasonable points. I can't make a conviction with the way you did this. It doesn't matter if you're right, Harry. I can't do this according to the law.
Yeah, in that scene, it's actually pretty hard to defend Harry. It's almost insulting that he is pretending he doesn't get it. Bro, you knew what would happen if you just went rogue and broke the rules. These rules are there for a reason, not just to thwart you. And if you cared about justice, you would have gotten a warrant. You're a cop. You know this. But he's acting so surprised. What are you talking
about?
I have to follow the rules.
Harry is the audience who doesn't know these things, because even now people probably don't know these things, and they certainly didn't 50 years ago.
You know, I honestly started off thinking about this film and being like, yeah, the politics aren't that savory, but whatever, it's a fun movie. But the more we talk about it, the angrier I'm getting, the more I'm kind of viewing it as a piece of propaganda.
I'm mad at a lot of people talking about this now, and I don't think that's a bad thing. This movie stirred me up. Harry's frustrating at times, as talented as he is, as great a cop as he is. You can't really sympathize with Scorpio in any kind of way, except when he is saying, I deserve my lawyer and all that kind of thing. He isn't wrong, though, too. So credit to Don Siegel. We haven't even said his name yet. So he directed this movie. We've only covered him once before, and it was 5 or so years ago. Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the original one, 1956, which is probably actually not as good as the one in 1978 that Philip Kaufman did. And I mentioned Outlaw Josie Wales. He got fired from that movie by Clint Eastwood. He was supposed to direct that film.
Kaufman or Siegel?
Coffin was. Siegel and Eastwood are longtime friends. They worked together many times. Siegel also did a very good film, which I saw again within the last 6 months, Escape from Alcatraz. Really good movie where Eastwood plays a real-life person who, spoiler alert, escaped from Alcatraz. He and two other guys.
Thanks for nothing. I haven't seen it yet.
But Siegel didn't direct any of the sequels to this series. Eastwood directed at least one of them and maybe a few of them. I forget exactly the number of that now. The same year as this, Eastwood was also in The Beguiled that Don Siegel directed. And Eastwood directed his very first film as a director, Play Misty for Me. Of course, he's also the star of that film. So he's in all these movies in 1 year, directed by the same guy twice. And this is the one that stands out the most. But I do recommend giving those movies a view if you've ever seen them before. Play Misty for Me. And The Beguiled, of course, was remade a few years ago by Sofia Coppola. But Siegel is also a producer on this movie. And Eastwood was an executive producer. His company, Malpasso, did produce the film, or one of the many producers of the movie. I don't know what Siegel's stances are on things, because Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you could read as a lot of different things. Very political film, though, too, as I remember when we covered that many years ago. Eastwood, we know his politics, but he seems like he's relatively reasonable as a Republican. He was, I think, all along. We know about the thing with the chair at the convention many years ago, the Republican convention. But if Eastwood is one of these people that actually supports the way things are, the Republicans now, truly is supporting it, I never hear him say that, I'd be surprised, because he seems like a relatively reasonable person. He's the one that said about gay marriage, if two people find each other, two men, two women, what do I give a shit? Which is what the Republicans used to be about, which is stay out of my life. I don't care what you do in the privacy of your own home, rather than what they do now, which is getting everybody's private life if they don't like what they do. But that's what I find fascinating about a movie like this, which is the politics by the two filmmakers. We know one for sure is a Republican and has been for a very long time. I don't know about Siegel so much. Probably a Republican in his own right.
I don't think a Democrat made this movie.
Well, fair. And then we mentioned John Milius was one of the writers, but uncredited on this movie. We know he's a Republican, but also a very talented guy who also did all kinds of different movies in Hollywood, especially in the 70s. He's one of the underrated people in the 70s. People talk about the directors, and they should. Scorsese, Spielberg, Coppola, Altman, Hal Ashby, on and on and on, who did so many great movies in the 70s. But Milius, who did direct a little bit, was also writing some of the better movies, or had a hand in them, like this one as well. And then Harry Fink and Rita Fink, who was credited as RM, probably because they want to be credited as a woman.
A lady! She can't write a movie!
And Dean Reisner also wrote Play Misty for Me this same year as this, for Eastwood. So I think maybe Eastwood brought him in to maybe rewrite. I forget what that was, the order that was. But the Finks, who also have story credit, or character credit, I guess it is, on all the sequels. So I guess they made money on this for many years because they got character credit, were the writers in this thing. Bruce Surtees shot it, the 2:39:1 print. We saw the DVD that I've had for many years. Thought it looked pretty solid for a movie of this age. Surtees worked with Clint many times, also shot a Planet of the Apes movie, and Beverly Hills Cop, one of the most successful R-rated movies of all time. The editor, Carl Pingator, did only 10 edits, including The Beguiled and Play Misty for Me the same year. Three movies he did in 1 year with Eastwood.
These guys just spent
only 10 in total.
All that time together. This whole crew just kept making movie after movie.
Well, Eastwood is very loyal to his crews. You look at his credits over and over and over. The Unforgiven era, especially in the early 90s. The movies before that, and definitely the ones that followed. It's the same production designer, the same cinematographer, the same editor, and a lot of the same actors, many times over. But of course, Eastwood is so great to work with. They talk about how, as a director, he gets it in one or two takes, and then that's it. We're working an 8-hour day. Maybe. That's a long day for Eastwood. And the composer, this movie was nominated for the top 25 music scores, was Lalo Schifrin, who's nearly 90, and it looks like he's still working. Did the sequels.
Is he still working for Clint?
Well, I don't know about for Eastwood so much. Well, Eastwood directs.
Well, they're just both in their 90s.
Eastwood composes. Right, that's true. Eastwood composes his own movies all the time now, or his son does.
Wow.
But Schifrin did the music in Cool Hand Luke, and Chris and I covered Enter the Dragon, and there's so many other credits that Schifrin has put out there over the years. So the movie technically is not something that really stands out. It's not really what it's for, but I think it really does work that way, especially the editing. This movie is only an hour and 43 minutes long, and it's a good example of what Spielberg said about Casablanca. Michael Curtiz gets into the scene when it's interesting, and he gets out before it's not interesting anymore. And this movie is mostly like that, too. I think knows when to shut up and move on.
It has a bit of a slow start. The first act dragged for me. That's also because it was made in 1971. Mm-hmm. It feels like a more modern movie than it is. It feels like it belongs in the 80s. So many of those 80s action flicks, and I'm thinking especially of Jean-Claude Van Damme movies, the quick, silly cop movies that came out that really followed this blueprint really closely, are such a calling card of 80s film that it's easy to forget how old this movie is, that it was made 4 years after Bonnie and Clyde. Truly one of the newer modern movies and on the front end of the 70s revolutionizing Hollywood. I'll agree with you about the editing, 100%. Also, I think the cinematography is great. Exciting framing and shots and information that's conveyed visually in really creative and meaningful ways. And there's that really cool shot in the stadium. I don't know how they did it, because I'm pretty sure this is before they had gyroscopes on helicopters, where they pull away, it has to be in a helicopter, where he's torturing him in the middle of the stadium. What a great idea. I know that they were taking advantage. They had this idea, but to put them square in the middle of the stadium, an empty stadium, and have him torturing. That image, this is what I'm talking about. This is beautiful propaganda. And that shot stands out so much.
And if you cut back a couple thousand years, that'd be a gladiator situation where people would be watching this and, kill him, Harry! And Harry probably would, although he needs to get the girl out who's already dead. And as you said earlier, that's one of the examples of full frontal nudity. That poor girl who had to do that one scene. No dialogue, completely naked. But this movie does show an awful lot of nude bodies, I think effectively for the most part. But you said earlier, they're probably trying to appeal to young men by showing some casual nudity. But it's not sexual nudity. When Chris and I talk about, can you score this movie? If we had done this movie, I would say no, even though there are a lot of great boob shots, including Hot Mary. But yeah, it's not sexual.
And that's a sexual situation. And the strip club is a sexual situation.
But you it's not sexy. Why?
It's because Harry himself is totally sexless.
Okay, yeah.
He talks about how his wife died, but there's no romance in the film at all. That's actually kind of a striking thing, that there's no girl for him to win at the end for all of his heroics,
that's
which
true.
Would be common in just about every other cop movie ever made. There would be a girl introduced in the first act who would be put in peril, and then at the end they would kiss, and that's how you know he won. There's none of that
I've
here.
Been watching a lot of old movies lately. They're on YouTube for free. And they really do jam in that thing of, I'm going to kiss the girl at the end. And they did build it up. That was part of the subtext or even the text of the whole film. But it does feel like after what we've just seen, that's where you got to go with this right now. But then that's what movies did so often. It's like that line in Bad and the Beautiful. I want to kiss at the end and black on the books. And so many movies have done that over the years, probably tens of thousands by now. But you're right. The only women in this movie that we really see other than Chico's wife, who has that little scene where he does describe what happened to his wife and kid as well, I think it was. Or am I thinking of...
No, I'm thinking
of Last Boy Scout, where his wife and kid were killed by a guy who jumped the curb, did not mean to do it, complete freak accident, and that did mess up the Damon Wayans character to some degree, and one of the reasons why he's a drug addict now, because of this stupid chance thing that nobody meant to do, and that's also what happened to Harry's wife. I thought after the black doctor, by the way, he's the one who stitches him up, and they seem to know each other pretty well. He wants to cut Harry's pants off, but Harry says, no, they cost $29.50. That's how his dead wife first comes up. We don't know what happened to her until later on when he talks to Chico's wife about that. And Chico, by the way, even though he does quit the force, and I don't think that Renny Santoni ever worked in these movies again, this series again, he does save Harry from being shot, because one of those typical talking killer moments, Scorpio is going to shoot Harry by that cross. He was going to do it. But Chico, who was following along the whole time, that's a pretty long sequence too, where Harry's running all over town as the bag man with the money. And Chico gets hurt and could have died in that sequence, but he saves his partner long enough for Harry to stab Scorpio, and then he runs off, and we have the next day. I thought maybe, I haven't seen this movie in a while, I thought maybe the whole thing was supposed to be that Harry tracked him down one long night in the football stadium, and that's where he does the step on his leg, and where's the girl? I want my lawyer! But that was supposed to have been sometime later, as of course was the big black guy that beats the living fuck out of Scorpio, so that it can look like it was Harry that did it. And it's easy to believe, for Harry's superiors and the general public who might know anything about the story, that Harry did beat him up like that.
But do you believe, at any year, if there is a serial killer on the loose, a la Zodiac, which the whole country was terrified of, especially San Franciscans, that if a cop had found the Zodiac killer and beat him up, whether he deserved it or not, you think the public would turn against that cop? Or even his superiors would turn against him?
I have an easy answer. You can't say he's a suspect in this case when you don't have evidence, because Harry messed it up by going in illegally without a warrant.
Yeah, but the public knows that he's the killer.
No, they don't. And why would the cops release that information? They may also be thinking, okay, well, he has to do some more things one more time and then we will get him. But the public knowledge is that he didn't do anything wrong. It has to be, because he has to be released because Harry is torturing a suspect. But there's no actual proof yet that you can actually put through the proper system.
Okay, okay. I was under the impression that the public would know.
Don't forget what we know as an audience. That's very important when you watch movies, too.
If somebody's let go on a technicality, that's public knowledge. So the public would know about it, especially if that person then becomes more of a figure because they're accusing someone of police brutality.
But it didn't go through the courts because he goes to jail as somebody who supposedly killed this girl. But there hasn't been any kind of court case yet because Harry violated his rights.
No, but a lawyer would have to argue that in order for the case to get thrown out. A lawyer would have to go to trial, to a hearing, and say, Your Honor, there was no warrant, this doesn't count, and then the judge would have to agree.
Well, if you're right, then that's part of the fantasy of this movie then, too.
Yeah, and like I said, it's kind of like the Ayn Rand school of writing a plot to just make all the characters suit your needs to make your point. But there's never been a person like Scorpio, who's a criminal in every way you can imagine, completely batshit, over the top, hijacks a school bus, terrorizes the children. He's a frothing at the mouth.
He's killing people for no reason, too. It's not like he's doing it for any kind of I'm going to get revenge thing. We covered Saw a couple years ago. Every one of the Saw movies, they don't deserve what happens to them, but Jigsaw and then the apprentices think they have justification for why they kill these people. They're not just random people. They're always for a purpose, as crazy and as awful as that may be. In this movie, Scorpio's killing beautiful women in pools on rooftops. That's a really well-shot scene at the very beginning of the film, by the way. And then the girl who's down in the ground that does suffocate. And he talks about wanting to kill a padre. And then, of course, the school kids on the bus. They don't die, but he would have been fine if they had. He has no motivation. Which, again, is also a straw man thing where they do it because they might hate this person, that person, or that type of person.
It makes me think of the second half of Quentin Tarantino's career where he just makes one movie after another where he creates a villain or borrows a villain from history who is so vile that your hero has permission to commit grotesque violence against them. I think the difference being that Tarantino is winking at us as he's doing it. Don't you like the violence? I did this for you so that you can just enjoy watching Hitler getting torn to ribbons by a hail of bullets.
Which I do like watching.
Alive. I do like watching it. You're right, Tarantino. You're right, QT. I love this. More, please. But his villains are so ridiculous and over the top. But he's just doing that so he can have permission to have these violent acts and let the audience enjoy the catharsis of it. Versus this movie that's doing it to make a political point. Okay. Or to appease the people that already believe this point and want to see it exhibited.
Well, Clint Eastwood argued in the making of, and also I'm sure at the time, making of was made, of course, many years later, probably at least 20 years later, maybe even 30 or more years later. He argued for victims' rights. What about the victims? Which I guess his character says in the movie, but he says it very plainly in the making of. You hear about how this person had their rights violated, the Miranda warning, of course, for example. But we do have to follow procedures. That's one of the things that's very frustrating about any job. And I certainly have complex feelings about the cops. I get completely why black people don't trust police. Any of them. They probably shouldn't.
No.
Especially in America. But we still need some kind of police presence. It can't just be we have no police. And when you, again, hear the defund the police thing, it isn't no cops at all. It's about a more reasonable way of doing things. For example, somebody has a freak out, for example. They're naked on their front lawn.
No butcher knife, though.
Okay, right. Not that. But they're ranting and raving at people and, oh my God, those space lasers are going to kill us all. You don't send 3 or 4 or 12 armed
cops.
People.
Yeah.
You send a social worker.
You send somebody who is an expert in talking down somebody who's clearly having an episode.
Mm-hmm.
Defund the police is reform the police, but I think that police reforms in the past have been really half-assed.
That's why they don't want to call
effective
it
effective enough. They don't want to use that terminology, and I understand it. And to be honest, I just don't know enough about it to really get in the weeds. But I do know that there's a massive problem that needs to be solved.
Oh, there's a reason.
Anybody who disagrees with defund the police better come at me with an alternative to defund the police to solve the massive problem.
I don't disagree with that at all. Yeah. I don't disagree with the people that say that something has to be done about this. I certainly said that last year, and we covered a few podcasts that talked about this exact issue. My point is, let's be pragmatic. You say that to Joe Average, who doesn't know anything to begin with, and you're going to turn them off.
And there is people who, it doesn't matter how you put it, they're never going to agree. They're never going to want
They're not the people I'm talking about, though.
No, that's fair. There's the middle ground of people who can be convinced, and the messaging isn't really ideal.
Now, as far as the movie goes, too, when you talk about Harry being a good guy, and he is on the heroes list, one of the best shots in the whole movie is when the bus is about to go under a bridge. Harry has got complete foresight to know where this bus is going. But Harry looks like a horror villain standing on the bridge. He looks like, without a mask, Michael Myers just standing there so placidly. You're going to come to me. I'm going to jump on this. And apparently Eastwood did that stunt for real.
He did that stunt
and
for real.
And because there's no digital effects back then, it's pretty obvious he did. Apparently he did all of his own stunts, or at least most of them.
And it looked dangerous. dangerous. There's a point where you can see him struggling to stay on. Yeah, I'm like, oh my God.
He's also on that cherry picker. He directed that scene as well because it was just easy for the actor who's up there with the other guy to stop the jumper. I mentioned Mel Gibson, Lethal Weapon. Well, Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon has a scene where he stops a jumper, but he goes over with the jumper handcuffed to him and they land in this giant airbag type thing. But anyway, when Eastwood's standing on that bridge, I almost in a way felt bad for Scorpio because he looks like Michael Myers or Jason Voorhees coming to kill you.
Yeah.
But I guess he is, and he's got that giant hunter's gun. So we've talked about Eastwood so much, of course, the star of the movie and one of the biggest stars ever in Hollywood. He's certainly on that list now of Hollywood icons. You think about film, Eastwood's somewhere in that conversation. The only movie we've ever covered him in before, unless I forgot something, was Unforgiven, which was on the Top Gun project a long time ago. And Chris and I did Million Dollar Baby for Scoring at the Movies a while ago, but that is it for any podcast I've ever done until now. And we probably will still do The Good, the Bad, the Ugly this year, but we're putting it off because it's a very long movie, probably an in-depth podcast, and we're moving soon. This is already a long podcast itself, but that's why I thought I'll put it off maybe till later in the year when we've moved and we're settled in.
I just thought my favorite Eastwood movie is a movie about a criminal who kidnaps a child and gets killed by police, but by the time the police kill him, you're crying like a baby because you're so attached to him. You don't know what I'm talking about? A Perfect World.
Oh, that's a good
one. Kevin Costner.
I was picturing, for some reason, Changeling.
Oh, okay. No.
That's not my son. She's a good actress, but holy God, stop making her say that 212 times in one movie.
Anyways, saying, obviously, Eastwood has some pretty nuanced views because that movie is beautiful.
That was the great run of films because he did direct that and co-starred it, but Costner is the main star in that movie, actually, and the kid with him is very good, too. But Unforgiven was 92. That was 93. Also in 93 was In the Line of Fire, an excellent film
yes. That
Wolfgang Petersen directed, and then he kept on going. If he had stopped in 2000 when he was already 70, he would have said, what a great career, and then he still went on to make Million Dollar Baby, Letters from Iwo Jima, American Sniper, Gran Torino. Some of those are great. Some of those are not so great. Some other movies I didn't just mention right now. Trouble with the Curve is terrible. But he made so many other films and is still doing it now. And that is something else, that he's still making movies in his early 90s now. By the way, the inspector thing that he is, so Inspector Harry Callahan, is a San Francisco-specific thing. So it would be Detective Harry Callahan, but they call it Inspector. And he does have that Smith & Wesson 44 Magnum, which is an iconic gun in movies. Of course, Travis Bickle has it. But that is all about, just like in Taxi Driver, this isn't about defense. It's, I'm going to blow your head clean off. Andrew Robinson, in his debut, got death threats because he made this movie. How dare you be a very effective villain in a movie?
I know, he had to unlist his number.
Calm down, people. He's a fucking actor.
People are so stupid.
But he went on to be in Mask, so meaning the 85 one, Eric Stoltz, and Hellraiser as well, a couple years after that. He was a stage actor that I think Eastwood saw and thought,
yes. That
guy's perfect to play Scorpio. Renny Santoni went on to do Cobra with Andrew Robinson, who's also in that, and then he did a lot of voiceover work. We mentioned John Vernon, Joseph Sommer, and Harry Gardino already. Of course, Siegel directed, the writers, the producers, and the technical people. We talked about all those people, I guess, already, so we can move on to what happens next. Forgetting that there are sequels, and one of them, by the way, does co-star Tyne Daly, I believe, so he does have a lady partner. I don't think they get romantic. Maybe they do. I don't recall. But one of them at least has a woman with a significant role. But forgetting all those, Harry becomes a private eye in the Bogart mode. Seems suited to him.
It's very neo-noir, so it would be appropriate.
Yep. Or he becomes a psycho killer himself. He's already a killer. Or Batman. Because he is Batman. A vigilante, like Paul from Death Wish. That series, actually.
Yes, this movie's an origin story.
And Popeye Doyle. And all those movies, by the way, Death Wish had several sequels. French Connection had at least one sequel. And this had four sequels. So these vigilante cop movies were obviously successful, and they kept on making more and more of them.
Today's equivalent would be stuff like Taken and John Wick.
Right. Or, of course, as you've said already a few times, the MCU.
Well, they're very different from this movie in lots of ways, certainly in tone, but I think in the ethos and their politics, they're incredibly similar. They're very Republican movies. So I compiled a list of things that happened in this movie that weren't cliche at the time, but I guess this movie was so popular and influential that they have become notorious cliches. You've got the, I don't need a partner situation where they're putting a partner on him and the partner went to college. Obviously, he's dead weight.
But especially if you say blank, i.e.
Right.
Mexican.
Which is not what he calls him.
No.
Yeah.
That's why I said blank.
Yes. He feels no pain. Think of every action hero that just gets shot and keep going. He knocks over a fire hydrant with his car. I almost laughed out loud when I saw that because that just feels like a ridiculous cartoonish cliche. You've got the conflict with his chief and the mayor. Suicidal person lingering on the edge of a building. You already talked about how that happens in Lethal Weapon, and we've seen it in 100 TV shows that a cop has to talk somebody off of the ledge, and that's just part of their job, which is ridiculous. Why would you send Harry up there? Oh, and of course...
Well, every dirty job.
Oh, and the last one is that the ending has the killer taking a child hostage at this child out of nowhere appears conveniently. You, kid, come here. He takes him hostage. Something, again, we've seen over and over and over.
But the guy's an incredible shot. Shoots anyway. And that kid's probably traumatized forever. And as far as the jumper goes, great example of defund the police. You'd send up the social worker, either with the cop or just the social worker.
Look how he gets him down. He punches him.
Barely holds onto him, too, because the guy is knocked out and is starting to fall.
Oh my god, it's ridiculous.
Okay, that's it for a very complex movie, Dirty Harry. And I don't think it's fair to call this movie fascist. Well, maybe that, I guess, is probably fair in some ways. But simple, no, that's not fair. This movie has a lot of things going on in many scenes. We do learn more things about Harry than you might think because of the wife. And some of the things you can understand why he would do them, but he still does cross the line. But you want somebody like this in these circumstances when it was the actual Zodiac killer in reality. And by the way, Dave Toschi in Zodiac, Mark Ruffalo, goes to watch Dirty Harry, and that is based on him. So there's another connection in this movie, and we already mentioned McGonagall, and of course all the sequels and the vigilante movies that were either the same time as this or soon after it, the 70s superheroes, but awfully flawed superheroes. In 7 days, we'll cover another one of those puzzle films that came out in 2001, and this might be the last one of them. So Donnie Darko, Mulholland Drive, Memento, we've covered all of those. Finally, we get to Vanilla Sky. It's probably Tom Cruise's best performance, or certainly one of his best performances. And what I saw online looking this up a little bit, he supposedly thinks it's his best work. So the coming attraction's opinion question for Vanilla Sky. Discounting Nicole Kidman, because she'd be the runaway winner of this game if we included her, which of Tom Cruise's past wives or girlfriends is the best actress? Mimi Rogers, Katie Holmes, so they're the wives along with Kidman, but those two only in this little game. Penelope Cruz, or reportedly, Rebecca De Mornay. You got four choices there.
Reportedly they dated, or reportedly she's a good actress?
Both, but they dated apparently after, or maybe during, Risky Business. I also read about Cher and some other people, but we won't include her, because I don't think he dated Cher. I think that might be bullshit, but I have heard many times over about Rebecca De Mornay, and we know he dated Cruz, Penelope Cruz.
Okay, so for the answer to that question, check out next week's podcast about Vanilla Sky. Until then, you can get more from us by visiting our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project.
Or both.
Wherever you listen, wherever fine podcasts are sold, all our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 07 list of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles on top of that. Over 400 titles, as a matter of fact. In exchange for all of this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. We're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code top100project at checkout. And that's all one word, just top100project. It's not case sensitive. And that will get you a 20% discount.
I just remembered at the end of the podcast that we're posting this on Labor Day. We don't usually work on Labor Day, but we are this time because we're probably going to be off later in the month when we move.
We're laboring on Labor Day.
So in honor of that, every dirty job.
And cut.